How did you start saying at the end of your broadcast, and that's the way it is?
Well, that was a very contrived sign-off, obviously, and I'm a little embarrassed about it today. Dick Salant, the sainted late Richard Salant, who was president of CBS News when we went to the half hour, hated it and tried to talk me out of it, but being the stubborn Dutchman I am, I clung to it, and it became so much a signature so quickly that I was not inclined to give it up. But what happened was when we went from a half hour to a half hour, I thought we'd have plenty of time. Fool that I was, naive as I was, I thought that doubling our time would give me time to end the piece with the kind of stories I always liked when I worked for the United Press and Scripps Howard. I liked the irony of fate stories, the little one-paragraph stories or two-paragraph stories that you put under an italicized head somewhere in the front page. And they were the little human interest touches. And if I use that kind of story, knowing that sign-off lines were terribly popular in broadcasting and always have worked for people, I thought maybe I could use one if I could find one that I could say as a tagline to either a humorous or a pathetic story. And you can say, and that's the way it is, almost anyway. And that's the way it is, you know, an ironic touch or a satirical touch, or doubting touch. And that's the way it is, a sad touch and a regretful touch. And so that's why I devised the line, and it certainly has stuck.
You say you're embarrassed about it now. Why are you embarrassed?
Because I think Dick Salant was right. We didn't get to use those irony of fate stories. Almost from the beginning of the evening news, there was so much news to cover in the half hour allotted to us, less than that, less subtracting commercials and lead-ins and lead-outs and so forth. There was so much to cover. We never got those irony of fate stories in. As a result, we were loading the broadcast with important news, and I was ending up saying, and that's the way it is, an arrogant line, in a sense.
Right, that's how some people saw it, that you were saying, I've told you what the news is, and that's all there is.
Well, not only that's all there is, but it's all correct.
Yeah, right.
And as Dick pointed out, we're not telling them all that is, and we make mistakes.
You were the anchor and managing editor of the evening news. When you became the anchor and managing editor, what were some of the changes you made or tried to make?
Well, I think the most important change was that I insisted on doing the broadcast from the desk where I worked. So there would not be a delay in getting from the newsroom to the broadcast location, the studio. And also, I would be in control throughout the half hour of the broadcast. The reason for that was that I really was the managing editor, and I did not want to put copy on the air that somebody had prepared and handed to me. I wanted to see it off the wires. I wanted to make my own judgment on it before going on the air with it. And that was possible if we were in the newsroom operating. They could hand me the press service copy. The teletypes bringing the press service copy could be practically at my elbow. And I could have writers and researchers sitting around the rim of the anchor desk, just as they would on a newspaper, I played it that way.
Well, speaking for myself, if I did a broadcast from my office, instead of hearing what I was talking about, listeners or viewers would just be saying, what a mess. You must have been under a lot of pressure to keep a pretty neat desk if you were broadcasting from it.
Not really. We swept the desk clean about one half minute before going on the air. My motto was, our deadline is when we leave the air. We changed the broadcast right through to the time I signed off. It very seldom ended up precisely as we had planned it in advance. It drove producers and directors and technicians crazy, but that's the way I believed it should be done. There was no reason we had to close out the broadcast before we went on the air. If you've got capable people who can handle it on the microphone, on the cameras, and in the control room, there's no reason why you can't update that broadcast to the very last second.
We're remembering Walter Cronkite. He died Friday at the age of 92. Let's get back to my 1993 interview with Cronkite. Let's talk about what I think for many Americans it was one of your most memorable moments as a broadcaster. And I mean, it was a shocking moment in broadcasting. I'm sure you know what I'm getting at. It was the day Kennedy was shot, and you made the announcement on CBS that he was shot, and then made the announcement that he was dead. How did you end up being the one to go on the air?
Well, I was the one who carried most of the burden of our spontaneous or extemporaneous news coverage in those days. I was the anchor man of the evening news and usually the broadcaster of conventions, elections, things of that kind. So it would not have been unnatural for me to do it. But actually, the fact was that I was in the newsroom preparing the evening news broadcast. I was there right when the wires, the United Press had the beat. Merriman Smith, the White House correspondent for United Press, got the first break, and the bulletin bells rang on the machine. We all gathered around, and there was the news that shots rang out, and today is President Kennedy's motorcade toward the streets of Dallas. Bing, 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 another bulletin. The motorcade is broken up, and it appears that it's on the way to a hospital. President Kennedy may have been hit. And with that, well, we immediately ordered up the air and went on the air. We couldn't get the camera warm immediately. In those days, we didn't keep one warm for those purposes, although after this experience, we did. But they started warming up a camera and moving it into place in the newsroom. Meanwhile, I went into an announce booth and went on the air as a voiceover over a bulletin slide over a soap opera that was on at the time.
When you went on to say that Kennedy was dead, your eyes teared, and that's something that we've seen replayed so many times on, you know, every anniversary of the death. And I mean, it's become one of these historic moments of broadcasting. Were you concerned about getting emotional on the air? Did you try to be as emotionless and stoic as possible? And were you concerned when you realized that your eye was tearing?
Well, I wasn't concerned about my eye tearing. I was concerned about my voice choking and not being able to speak. And that concerned me quite a lot. The tearing didn't matter. I didn't really think about it except the concern that I wouldn't be able to get the words out.
How close did you come to not being able to get them out?
Pretty close, I think. I remember a moment of real terror that I was going to choke up and fall apart, as it were.
As a journalist and broadcaster, did you think it was acceptable to let some emotion show?
Oh, yes, I think it was then, and I think it is now. I don't think if one happens to be an emotional type and has a little problem with that, perhaps, that there should necessarily try to suppress it. It could be overdone. If one were so emotional that every story broke him up, that would be unacceptable, obviously. But to have it happen once or twice in a broadcasting career is not that exceptional.
Walter Cronkite, recorded in 1993. He died Friday at the age of 92. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.